Hey everybody, welcome to Surface Level, creating a community where Black and queer folks are fearless in thought and curious at heart. I'm one of your hosts, Tony, and today, Jordan, Damon, and I are discussing how both family and government institutions play a role in queer invisibility. How has seeking approval of our sexuality strained relationships with our parents? How have those experiences shaped how we've navigated life and exist today? This is Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We know a lot about that, and none of us were in the military.
But we know about that. We know about that phrase.
We know about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yeah. And we're really excited because today we have a special guest that we are very honored to have landed here for ourselves to have the conversation and also just for our listeners. I think people will be really excited and gag when they find out who we have with us today. So I'm going to get right into our introduction. So today's guest has a remarkable story. He was thrown out of his mother's home at the age of 16 in New Jersey for being gay. After 10 years homeless, he joined the U.S. Marine Corps, where he became a combat documentarian. After finishing the Marines, he went on to graduate from Columbia University and later NYU's Tisch Graduate Film Program. His award-winning short films have played in almost 150 film festivals worldwide, including Sundance, Outfest, and the American Black Film Festival. And fun fact, Jordan, Damon, and I were first introduced to his work when we watched his series called My House on Viceland, which takes a look into the world of New York's ballroom scene. And his latest project is The Inspection, an incredible film based on his life, starring Jeremy Pope and Gabrielle Union. So today, we're very honored to welcome Elegance Bratton to our Surface Level family.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, we are really excited to have you, and you know, you're traveling, and so we definitely appreciate you making the time to share this space with us. And as we do here at Surface Level, we like to start with an icebreaker, you know, warm up the girls, get us all acquainted. And so I'm going to call this game, because we're sticking with a theme here, military theme, and we're going to call this game, Thank You for Your Service.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not salacious, but, you know, I'm going to add some salaciousness to the mix because that's just, that's how I do. And so, it's just a little fun trivia about the military. And what's fun about that is, like, Damon, Jordan, and I, we are military girls, but we have family that are in the military or have been in the military, veterans in our family. And Elegance, we know that you were in the military. And so I would like you to answer the questions last to not tip these girls off, just in case you still remember some of this trivia, because I know you're not currently, you know, in the military. So first question, how many branches of service exist in the U.S. military? Is it A, 8, B, 6, C, 5, or D, 7? Damon and Jordan, we're going to start with you girls.
Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines.
I think
there have to be more than that because I didn't get 4 as an option.
SEAL is the same thing as Navy SEAL.
Yep.
Okay, say them again.
Teamwork. Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, National Guard.
Yes, because it's air, we have land, we have amphibious, which is marine.
It's like Avatar.
I think that's everything. That's 5, right? Was it 5?
So you girls came up with 5. Elegance, what's your answer to this?
Oh man, I'm really nervous now. I'm not sure.
It doesn't look...
Coast Guard.
Don't matter.
I always thought it was 4 myself. Army, Navy, Marines... and the other Air Force.
Okay.
The smart ones. The Air Force. But is the Coast Guard an actual
branch
thing? I don't know.
Tony.
You girls are tipping all around it, and I love the group think. There are actually 6 because you got 5.
You got 5. Damn.
But you're very close because there's one that's not so obvious. So I'm gonna go through them. There's the Army, you know, we had that. Mm. The Navy, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, the Marine Corps, okay. And this one caught me off guard. Space Force.
Ah.
What
the fuck is that?
Is that NASA?
How do you know that?
Right. That's not like you don't have to. There's no danger involved.
Right. Like, it's like War it's of like, the Galaxies.
I'm Houston, like, all right. We have a problem.
Houston, we have a problem. Okay, so next question. The roots of this tradition began over 100 years ago. And traditionally, in New York City, the celebration coincides with Memorial Day weekend, where military ships parade through the harbor and dock for a week, allowing sailors to explore the city and civilians to thank them for their service. Is it A, Harbor Week, B, Dock Week, C, Fleet Week, or D, Sail Week? Damon and Jordan?
It's Fleet Week.
Jordan?
That feels too on the nose.
Because it's right.
It feels so on the nose.
Like, no, but like...
What answer would you like to pick?
I don't know. I'm thinking back to Sarah Jessica Parker.
Sarah,
yeah. I feel like they had a couple of those. I feel like it was... Fleet Week just feels really too topical for a gay podcast.
Now I know what your Grindr name is.
Exactly. Say hey.
Fleet Week bottom.
Not that.
I'm going to say sail week.
I'm going to catch you on Memorial Day weekend. Next go around.
I'm going to say sail week.
Okay, yeah. Elegance.
It is most surely Fleet Week. But why have just 1 week when Fleet Week
Fleet
every
year.
Day?
That could be a lifestyle.
So the answer, so you know what? The answer is Fleet Week, and it's basically, you know, Freaknik for the sailors.
Freaknik.
They bring up like a fleet of ships.
Okay.
It is Fleet Week, and when you see all the sailors around, they have on their regalia.
and the
regalia, the uniforms. And it's just, you know, something about a man in a uniform is just very appealing. And you know, all you hear all around the city is thank you for your service, thank you for your service. And a lot of them are being serviced.
My brother would love to hear you say that.
Anywho, the next question. What year was Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed? Was it A, 2014, B, 2011, C, 2009, or D, 2010? Damon and Jordan?
2011.
Jordan knows this because he did the research.
I think that's, yeah. I was in
preparation.
No, I just knew.
Uh-huh.
Or I'm not saying that's the right answer.
No, she just guessed. She just
we don't know. We don't know. It's a guess.
I think it is 2011.
Okay, and Elliot's?
I'm pretty sure it's 2011 because I got out 2010,
mm-hmm.
and I remember when it passed, and I was like, "Man, yeah. if they had got rid of this before my contract got up, I may have stuck around another handful of years."
Well, you're correct, 2011, and it would have been a shame if anyone on this podcast got it wrong in preparation for this episode. But yeah, that's when Barack Obama was in office. So
that's why I was like, I knew it was when Barack Obama was in office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A long 18 years, I believe it was, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place. Next question. This person was an American politician, statesman, diplomat, and United States Army officer who served as the 65th United States Secretary of State from 2001 to 2005. He was also the first Black Secretary of State.
I know the answer.
And I know Damon knows this.
I would like Damon.
But I would like Jordan to go first because Damon, she be knowing her history.
Well, what's the multiple choice?
Yeah. So the multiple choice, I'll give it to you. It's A, John Lewis, B, Jesse Jackson, C, Colin Powell, or D, Thurgood Marshall. You're verklempt.
Wink at me or something.
I got my Aaliyah bang. I'm high.
Hide behind that bang.
I'm gonna do a process of elimination.
Boy,
it's never really the first thing that people say because that's like a mind trick that I do with. Okay, so we're gonna take out the first option.
Don't project.
Wait, what are the options again?
A, John Lewis, B, Jesse Jackson, C, Colin Powell, or D, Thurgood Marshall.
It's Colin Powell.
Okay, you confident in that. Elegance.
I have to be confident because I don't know.
Well, Damon knows the answer, so Elegance.
But I agree. It is definitely Colin Powell.
Yeah, ding, ding, ding. That Colin Powell, quite legendary.
I love that.
An icon.
When in doubt,
iconic.
Pick C.
Mm-hmm, very iconic. So, lastly, a soldier's play written by Charles Fuller, black man, is a play centered around the murder of a black army sergeant and the search for the culprit. It was first staged in 1981 by the Negro Ensemble Company with a cast that included which famous actor? A. Lawrence Fishburne, B. Denzel Washington, C. Samuel L. Jackson, or D. Danny Glover? Damon and Jordan.
I'm going to go with Lawrence Fishburne because he's old enough to have done it then, and I know he's been on Broadway.
Okay.
I'm going to just increase our chances of maybe taking home a win and say Danny Glover.
Okay. Elegance?
I'm going to say Denzel.
Uh-huh.
I think it's Denzel.
Uh-huh.
I know the movie is someone else, but I can't remember.
Well, you know what? This was a trick question, and I gave two right answers, and Damon and Jordan got both of them wrong. There's two right answers.
Wait, say it again.
There's Lawrence Fishburne, Denzel Washington, Samuel L. Jackson, and Danny Glover. And there's two right answers in the multiple choice. Because you got it right, Elegance. It was Denzel, but also Samuel L. Jackson was in the original stage play in 1981.
You're learning something new every day.
Yeah, and I actually, when I was doing it, I knew Denzel was in it because I saw the what do they call it when they bring the revival of Soldier's Play when Blair Underwood and David Alan Grier
together?
Fantastic. Yeah, we did go on the same night. And I knew that Denzel was in it, but then I also put Samuel L. Jackson because I was like, he's done Broadway too. And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, he was actually in it.
Yeah, that's why I didn't pick Samuel L. Jackson because I just saw him. And I was just like, that's not how fate works out in multiple choice questions.
But just another piece of fun fact about this also, Charles Fuller was the second black playwright to win the Pulitzer for drama for a Soldier's Play.
Oh.
So that was a lot of fun. And lastly, Elegance, for you, we want to know what you're curious about in the world.
Just in general?
In general. It can be... You might be curious about what you're about to eat tonight for dinner. You might be curious about 2023 and what's to come, or some sort of policy that's coming up, or what's going on in your world with your work.
I think the thing I'm most curious about right now is probably... What am I curious about? I think I'm curious about, I don't really want to get into it because it's explosive.
Okay, well, we'll scratch the surface.
Yeah, just this whole conversation on The View with Whoopi Goldberg, I'm curious. I want to understand better what's going on there because I feel like I'm getting, to me, Whoopi Goldberg is such a smart person.
Yeah.
And I don't understand fully what is the issue. I'm actually in a process of educating myself about it right now.
That's a good one. I'm a avid watcher of The View, and I've been seeing some things and rumblings about what's going on there. And I actually saw your interview when you were on there with Gabrielle Union. Fantastic interview. But
for the listeners who may not follow The View, what exactly is the topic that we're discussing?
So I I'm in the same boat as Elegance where I'm getting information. I haven't actually gone to look and see what's going on, but I'm assuming that it has something to do with maybe her return for the next season. You know, I saw something online that was like, you can't shut Whoopi Goldberg up. Actually, it was a New York Times article that said, you can't shut Whoopi Goldberg up. And it wasn't a bad thing. It was to highlight, she says what's on her mind. But I am assuming that maybe there's some conversation about her return and maybe they're reviewing her contract for whatever reason. Maybe, you know.
And I'm also, okay. But see, the thing is, everything is so hot button right now. It's hard to really... The things that I'm looking at on my phone, like the Meg Thee Stallion, Tory Lanez, Kelsey situation, all of that is just what's going on? What's happening? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think if anything I'm curious about right now is where is the kind of intellectual reawakening of American media? When does that come back into fashion again? Because it just feels like everything is becoming entertainment. and it's hard to differentiate what is of meaning and importance and what is clickbait.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. All right.
Sorry, I get curious about really serious stuff.
we love it. All right. So, Elegance, I want to start here. We kind of talked about it a little bit in the game, but based on your experience as a gay Black man in the Marine, what role did the don't ask, don't tell policy play in your decision to enlist? We heard you say earlier in the interview that, you know, had the policy been done away with before you left, that you may have stayed a little bit longer. I'm curious to know, like, going in to the Marine, how did don't ask, don't tell impact that decision?
I mean, that don't ask, don't tell is the framework of how I grew up in my mother's home. My name is Elegance. It's been that since the day I was born. And in any room I've ever walked in, people have assumed that I'm Black and gay just by hearing my name before ever meeting me. And in most instances, that meant that I was met with a fair and certain amount of ostracism and rejection. So yeah, so don't ask, don't tell became the code of my life. You know, my mom was a prison guard. She would come home with these horrible stories of rapes in jail and people dying of AIDS in jail. And those, she was saying that to me as a cautionary tale about something she never even asked me. So, you know, don't ask, don't tell was, I was so used to it already that once I understood what it was, I was like, I can get through this. I've already been through this. I've already gotten my ass kicked most of my life because people assume that I'm gay. So at least this time I get a check and maybe I can go to college.
Yeah. That's interesting. I'm interested to know, because on first, hearing your name, I assumed this was a name that you, you know, you took on later in life. And to hear that this was your birth name was really interesting to me. Did you have any thoughts going into the military, knowing how people treated you prior to that based on your name? Did you ever have any thoughts or did you ever do anything to change your name or how you were addressed in the Marine?
No, I couldn't, because when I got to boot camp, like when you're in boot camp, you're lined up in the squad bay and the drill instructor reads off the names. So, you know, it's like John, Bob, Hakeem, you know, Farad, how do you say, you know?
Yeah.
Elegance. Who the hell is Elegance? You know what I mean?
And they look around, they're like, that one.
So there's really nothing I could do about it. It was no matter what I definitely have my aliases, you know what I'm saying? Like I have like every other Black man in America, I've got my street names and things like that. But at the end of the day, in my life, it's been Elegance the whole way through. So.
Got you. Okay. Yeah. That sparked my interest when you said that. I was like, because I know the character's name was French, and even that name in the inspection, I was just like, okay, this is a little bit an eyebrow raise too. So that's interesting to hear.
But just speak, like, to take a step back, just about don't ask, don't tell. Like, I feel that the policy, although when it came about during the Clinton administration, I feel like he and his administration were trying to do the work to sort of help, but it was doing, it actually did more harm, and it actually continued to create stigma around being LGBTQ plus. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, just for our listeners, to give them a bit of how this was written, and I'm gonna only read out one excerpt from what the policy did, but it said that the policy prohibited people who demonstrate a propensity or intent to engage in homosexual acts from serving in the armed forces of the United States because their presence would, quote, create an unacceptable risk to the high standards of morale,
good order and discipline and unit cohesion that are the essence of military capability. Now that sounds like some bullshit to me.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What is the propensity of homosexuality?
But also, I definitely have it, whatever it is.
You definitely have it, but just like it's saying like these are part of the essence of military capability.
Right.
I was like,
good order. I like to walk in and fuck shit up, so I shouldn't be in the military, period.
No, which, ma'am.
No.
I mean, the thing about it is that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, like you said, gets its name in the 90s, but in reality, since World War II, queer service members were forced to serve in silence or kicked out. Don't Ask, Don't Tell gives it a name.
Right.
Which then I get, in a way, is ultimately helpful in a liberal democratic society, because now you have a law to reverse. Whereas before you had an understanding, you know, let's not forget McCarthyism in the 1950s, you know, the kind of the pink commie red scare situation that was going on. So sure, it's called Don't Ask, Don't Tell by Bill Clinton. And on a personal level, you know, this is the loneliest time in my life. When you're in the military and you're getting promoted, you invite your lover, your spouse, to pin you on. You know, put your new ranking on your lapel.
Yeah.
When I got promoted, my commanders pinned me on. My mentors pinned me on. You know, so Don't Ask, Don't Tell had a catastrophic impact on my sense of self-worth, how I had sex, the amount of risk I was taking, all the things, you know, all the things that being kind of oppressed and suppressed, repressed does to people, to any human being. But again, I had already grown up with that. So it was kind of like, at least in this situation, I finally found a team that couldn't reject me. As long as I played by this rule that we all agreed to. Right, because most people in a homophobic society, you know, is not Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's like, you're gay, I'm gonna bash you, get out of here. Right, there is no deal in homophobia. Right, pure homophobia. This is tolerant homophobia. You know, which was an improvement over what I had been offered in my life up to that point.
Right, but even in watching the movie, it still seems, you know, it's tolerant. However,
it's not really actively being enforced.
Right. It's like, given they're going to give you a tougher time if they choose to.
Because they still might ask you. They still might ask you if you're gay. So moving into the next question, you spoke a little bit about self-worth and sort of what you were given as a child to embrace your identity. I want to talk a bit about the Black and queer experience in our relationship with our parents. Many of us have strained relationships with our parents due to either our sexual identity or our gender identity or both. My understanding is that you joined the Marine partly to prove your worth to your mother. And I wanted to know how you were able to move past the desire to meet your mother's expectations or gain her approval, and what that process looked like.
I don't know if I've ever moved past it, to be honest. I mean, my mother... The thing is, my mother's a complicated woman. She's the first person to ever love me completely. She's also the first person to ever reject me wholly. My mother was orphaned at the age of 10. And I've come to learn as I've gotten older, you can't give anybody something that you haven't been given first. And no one ever gave my mother the unconditional love that she was looking for. Because we're not, because to me, we're not broken up because she can't accept my sexuality. We're broken up because we live in a white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal society that chooses to silence and stigmatize my Black mom. You know, and as a result, she's looking for anything, any little rung to pull herself up on. And the next generation has to be that. But don't get it twisted. I started reading before I was 4 years old because of my mother. I went to the best school she could afford to pay for. She put on a uniform all of my childhood worked in a jail. And mind you, anybody who's in jail is in jail. Whether you're a prisoner, you're a prison guard, cafeteria lady, everybody in jail is in jail. Mm. She went to jail every day for 20 years to give me the foundation that would make it possible for me to overcome the homelessness that she put me through. So, you know, I don't see it in a black and white way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pain here. There's a lot of stuff, work I had to do on myself because of damage that she did to me. But there's also a lot of love and a lot of building that was done with the best that she had. And that's, and a movie is an honor to that complication.
Hmm. Yeah. Wow, that was... Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And one of the things that stuck out to me often, or the most in what you just said, is sort of your ability to empathize with your mother's experience growing. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, I've dealt with that issue a lot. I have a strained relationship with my father for a similar, you know, outlook on my sexuality differences. And I think the overwhelming feedback that I get from therapists, friends, et cetera, is to cut my father off. And it's one of those things that I have a really, really difficult thing doing because I don't see my father as this hateful person, but as someone who is desperately trying to make sure that they're able to survive and excel. And I truly believe that by me embracing my queerness, that I'm doing myself a disservice. And so it's just, that's something that I personally have had a lot of issues with coming to terms with, and I've been really conflicted about. So it was really helpful to hear you articulate it in that way. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I just think you got to, if there's anybody watching this or listening that's going through the same thing, all I can say is you can love people from a distance, and you can, and for me, loving my mom makes me feel better about everything that happened. Mm-hmm. And forgiveness is the greatest source of strength. It's not to say that you forget and you constantly open yourself up for victimization and abuse, but it is to say that you can forgive people, right? And move forward as a new self.
Yeah, when I think about that question, Jordan, and like a lot of us Black queer folks who are dealing with the strain of that parental relationship, I often go back to, for me, what it was. The strain was really the fact that I wasn't able to verbalize sooner who I am and didn't feel like I had the space to do that. And so thus creating a distance between myself and my parents from really knowing the person that I am. And not being able to invite them in sooner. And that is something I feel a lot of people probably can identify with, in terms of just creating that distance that we often sometimes find ourselves having. Damon, you have thoughts?
No. This is often not a perspective that I identify with. And I've thought a lot about it because, like, and what I've come down to, to give more context, my perspective is often choose the people that choose you, the titles that people have in your life through birth, right, don't have as much value. So there's, like, Jordan and I have spoken about this a lot over the years, just about someone is born this mother, father, sister, cousin, brother, friend of the family, and therefore we desire a specific type of relationship with them. And I've always wondered why, not wondered, but like as I've looked more into why I didn't necessarily think as much about that, I think about the fact that I have 5 siblings, 3 of us are adopted. Part of it is that I've grown up with parents who actively chose me. So even from the relationship that is supposed to be the one that we're just like given, that most people say, I'm supposed to have this relationship, it's given to me, so therefore it should look or feel in some way like love, mm-hmm. because those are your parents. My relationship with parenthood, not as a father. Oh, God, no. But my relationship with a parent comes from people who had to choose to be in my life and to take on that title because they wanted to and mm-hmm. because they wanted to pour into me. So therefore, like, I think a lot of times when I've said, like, choose people that choose you, it often sounds like, well, you don't want me to have a relationship with my mom, or you don't want me to have a relationship with my dad. And, like, that's not what it's about for me. It's just, even that relationship for me is about, has been about choice. And that is the example that I've mm-hmm. grown up with. So, like, I would say, in addition to loving people from afar, which is something that I thought was a very thoughtful thing that Elegant said, I think it's also realizing that even in every relationship, you can still choose what you want it to look like. You can still choose that it doesn't have to be because society tells you it should be in that way because you came physically from this person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there can be people you find that in no way are related to how you were born that can be just as powerful in the capacity of parent, of mother, of father, sibling.
100%.
Sure. That's the thing. All of it is true. All of it is helpful.
Yeah.
Grief and alienation, isolation, it's a combination therapy. It's a social cure. And all of it, you have to be in tune with yourself to know what you need when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then that will help you to trust your instincts. But I totally agree with that. I did that. You know, I walked away from a very abusive home, very, very young,
mm-hmm.
for the exact reason you're saying. But for me, mm-hmm. I held on to that love.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to be my full self and let that go.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just tried to do that in the most healthy way possible for myself, you know?
So Elegance, we've, on our podcast this season, we're addressing this idea of trauma porn. And we kind of want to bring it up with you because there's a growing sentiment among the Black queer community and just Black community in general, or just society in general, about a lot of stories in media that are anchored in trauma and hardship. So we've talked about the Jeffrey Dahmer series. We've talked about, like, the Central Park Five series. The list goes on. Do public opinions, like, around this topic and trauma porn play a role in your creative process or choices?
For sure. And again, I'm not in disagreement with that at all. I think there should be a variety of Black films and queer films and trans films, and you know, we deserve magic and we deserve fantasy, and I want to make those movies too, you know? So it's not to say that I'm in opposition to that. However, you know, we're living in a time where I understand the need to escape, but it's not like Black folks have ever gotten their history and their experience in a truthful fashion that is empowering to us from us. Mm-hmm. And that is an important thing that needs to exist and needs to be championed and supported as much as Black Girl Magic and Black Boy Joy, Black Gay Hope, and all these things. Because ultimately, magic, joy, hope, happiness without adversity, to me, is hollow. And ultimately, you know, and we're talking in the media landscape, you know, where streaming is becoming the way. And trust and believe, once they get enough Black Girl Hope Magic, Black Gay Joy
mm-hmm.
in the algorithm, that's it. And we need to get out of the mentality. So you think there's
a shelf life?
Yeah. You know, there's a shelf life to these films. I mean, at the end of the day, there has to be some, like people are like, we don't want to see any more slavery movies anymore. I'm like, because they're such a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
How many slavery movies have existed made by Black people?
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
And whether you like it or not, if you're Black in America, even if you're not born in America, slavery has a huge impact. And you should know that history. Like, that's why I admire my Jewish brothers and sisters, because they are able to contend with the horrors that have been put on them, and it inspires great storytelling. So no, I don't think that there should be one or the other. There should be more of everything. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel.
You know, I think, like, if we're talking about the process of creation, and for me, it always comes back to truth and truth through the lens in which you want to tell that, and it's connected to your experience. Like, we, this is our, the three of our creation. And one of the things that we look at on our show, or often we do questions that are kind of an inward look or critique of our experiences. May they be queer, may they be related to Black Lives Matter, may they be Black, whatever it is. And sometimes we'll get the feedback that'll be like, why are you criticizing Black Lives Matter? We need to all just do this thing. But our truth is to not just highlight the joys of our experiences, but to also interrogate the things that we can do better as a community. There's a point, there's like value to three Black queer men visibly sitting down and speaking about the beauty in which we've created, the beauty of our community, but also the things that we can do better on our own. And if we are not to talk about it, then who? Mm-hmm. Like it's to the point you were making, it's really just about controlling and being to tell our own stories through our actual lived experiences. And then, like, sometimes, in obviously we want to create conversation online and we're always welcome to having conversation, but that's been one of the things that, like, never quite sits well with me when people are like, well, why are you criticizing this thing? It's just like, why? My opinion is not to just throw heap and praise on a thing. It's to say, like, how can we always be a better version of it, or a more honest version of whatever truth that we're telling? And I think it's something that we'll continue to do here.
I just feel like it's a question of reparations to a certain extent, especially when you're thinking about the history of cinema, mm-hmm. right? Movies like Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. We could just go on and on and on of films that affirm, you know, racism, and these are box office hits, Oscar-winning films. And my version of civil rights and social justice requires a reparative approach mm-hmm. to this history of cinema. Mm-hmm. There needs to be, what was I watching? I was watching Woman King, mm-hmm. and I was like, wow, here we go. We have an answer in part to Lawrence of Arabia. Great, we need this. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? This, we have to address what's been done. We can't just move on mm-hmm. like nothing happened because it feels good to feel good. You know, but it feels good to feel good, and I want to feel good. You know? Yeah. So.
It feels good to feel good.
Yeah, I mean, we as Black stories in the media, obviously we're working at a deficit. So I personally am happy when these projects are happening regardless. And I can look at a project and say, you know, this is not necessarily something that resonates with me. This doesn't feel like something that I'll probably watch again. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody has a very unique story to tell. I love just bringing it back to the inspection just very quickly. That really resonated with me, being a Black gay child of two military parents. And so although I didn't serve, you know, I started to understand sort of what they may have gone through in boot camp, and also, you know, what they were exposed to as it pertains to sexuality mm-hmm. and the rhetoric that they were, you know, around when they were, you know, in their early 20s and still forming into an adult, and how that maybe have impacted the way that they look at queerness from being in those environments. So I get the critique that people want, you know, more joy, but I think that to just repeat what Damon always says on the podcast is do your research. There's a film for everything, but there's not enough. Mm-hmm. So instead of tearing things down because it's not your personal preference for entertainment, seek out what you want and let people create, especially when it's coming from a place of truth like the inspection. So.
Thank you so much. And please make stuff.
Right. Stuff.
Make what you want to see.
Exactly. So just also then highlighting some of kind of the accolades that are coming towards your film. So Golden Globes, they've been in a bit of hot water in the last couple of years. They were kind of called out for not having a single Black voting member. And this is the first time they're returning to air after a couple of years. Gerard Carmichael's hosting, so they're having a single Black host in your film.
He's also
Queer. So, yes. I love it. And then your film is also being highlighted with Jeremy Pope being nominated for Best Actor in a Drama. What does kind of the nomination mean for you? And just thinking about awards in general, how is that helpful to filmmakers and like yourself?
Oh, wow. The awards conversation, yeah, this is it's a first for me. It's my first movie. It's my first time being in an awards campaign. Mm-hmm. And it's all the emotions. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were premiered at Toronto, everyone says you shouldn't read the reviews. But yeah. The first like day of reviews, that first 24 hours, oh my God, they were so good. And I would just wake up in the morning thinking about them and start crying. I was filled with so much, you know, like just joy and gratitude and just, I'm so grateful to be in this position. So it means it's great, but it's also kind of toxic too. Cause it's like first place, second place, third place. Like when I go to the museum, I'm not thinking to myself, what's my favorite piece of art here? I'm thinking, great, art is awesome. You know, we love it. Mm-hmm. More art. Yay. You know? So the competitive aspect of it can be a bit tiresome. Just emotionally, it's exhausting to sometimes, but in the grand scheme of things, this is a blessing, you know. And for Jeremy to be nominated, it's strange because you don't come from where I come from and get to this position if you don't have a vision. And I can't say that I didn't put everything I had into this to give Jeremy the safest environment and the best chance to be the artist that I know he is. Mm-hmm. So to see him in this position now on our little tiny movie that we made for like no money in the summer in Mississippi, you know, I'm just so proud of him. I'm like, I can't believe it. I text him and he texts me back. I'm like, this is amazing. This is my friend. You know? So I'm excited for my boy, you know?
It's definitely a life-changing moment. And I feel like I totally get that competition spirit and thinking about reviews and what people have to say about the work that you're doing. And it's I forget who, was it Doja Cat when she won the Grammy, when she was like, you know, we always like, fuck these awards. But when you actually like get nominated, and then if you actually go on to win, it does mean something for you that that people in your community have taken a look at your work and said, this is the high standard of all the work that's being done. And not to say that everyone else's work is subpar, because everyone cannot win that trophy, but it does do something for the psyche.
These
are my heroes. Sorry to interrupt, but these are like some of these filmmakers, the people who get to make these decisions and who are deciding which films are contending and which films are not. These are my heroes. Like Lee Daniels wrote a thing for me in Variety on Directors on Directors.
Wow.
Lee Daniels, even now to this day, when people are like, who do you want to be when you grow up in the business? I like Lee Daniels is cool. I would like to do something like Lee Daniels does. So for him to say, I love your movie, the fact that these are my peers now, and I was in a homeless shelter 20 years ago. I feel I'm a very spiritual person. I grew up in the church. I'm not really in the church now, but you know, there's this idea in the Bible when Saul becomes Paul, you know, he's like struck by lightning, he's blind, and then he gets his sight back and he's a new person. That's how it feels. And I'm just so grateful.
Yeah.
You know?
And I also think beyond what it does for the spirit, it's just like winning these awards, being nominated for these awards are also begets more opportunity. They're particularly valuable for Black artists, brown artists, queer artists. I think so much about Lena Waithe and when she was writing on Masters of None. Mm-hmm. They had the Thanksgiving episode. I remember watching that episode. Mm-hmm. This was maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is the single best half hour TV I've seen all year. And yeah. then she went yeah. on to win that writing Emmy wow. that year. And like, you see how her
career. She was just, only like the second person. She was black person
to ever like win. Mm-hmm. Or she, no, she was. I think she was the first, and then when Quinta won it last,
she might have been the second.
Whatever. There have not been a lot of black people winning writing
it. It might be a grand total of maybe three.
Exactly. And like to see how her career has taken off and how many more opportunities have, and not to say that if that's the only reason, obviously good work, hard work, so on. Mm-hmm. And people put so much into their craft, but like when Viola Davis was just like the only thing that limits women of color and other women from succeeding is opportunity. Mm-hmm. These things create opportunity.
Yeah.
So like it definitely does so much to make you feel seen and make you under, like it drives you to, like to your point, to see your peers highlight you, but also thinking about it as a business, like it's, they're helpful to us. Shouldn't have to be, that but part. That's the reality.
That is the reality. You have to play the cards we're dealt.
Jordan.
Mm-hmm. I don't really have anything much to add other than congratulations. The nomination alone is a true honor. I was happy. Like we have a group chat, and we saw the news when the nominations came out, and we were all excited about it. And just very happy to see that, you know, your first film going on to receive this level of recognition. And it's just really beautiful to watch it all happen. It's a very compelling and very endearing story, and a very inspiring story for people who may be interested in getting involved in, you know, more creative industries. I think that you are your evidence that although there are gatekeepers in these industries, that you can create a path for yourself. Regardless of, you know, your history or, you know, sort of where you come from. And so I'm just happy to see this moment happen for you and more moments happen for you in the future. And yeah, I think that's all I have to say on that.
Well, I think
you're so sweet.
Speaking about more moments, first, Elegance, we'd like to thank you for taking the time on your travels to join our show. And we know our listeners will appreciate your perspective, but we want to know anything you can talk about. Obviously some things you can, maybe not, but anything you have coming up in the future, or how they can find you, or how they can find out more about the inspection and where to see it. Anything you want to share with our listeners?
Sure. In terms of where to find me, it's at Elegance Bratton on Instagram. At Langston Cruz on Twitter. And then in terms of work, I can't really talk about what I got going on because we haven't released it yet, mm-hmm. but I'm writing two films. They're going to be explosively inventive, interesting, and fun.
Okay.
Mm. And serious.
Love that combination.
Wait, can you at least tell us the genres?
The magical realism, historical magical realism.
Ooh.
And comedy. I don't know, I've been really obsessed with 70s cinema right now, so I just watched Holy Mountain recently, in this movie called The Devils, which I really, really liked, which is about the 17th century French Huguenot versus Catholic thing that happened. I'm really trying to like pierce the veil between experience and memory. Mm. And I have a personal belief that the body lives cultural memory. Like the, you know, all of the combinations of historical experiences within ourselves are in us, mm-hmm. and can be triggered and brought out, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to find ways to break the barrier between the real and the imagined and the world that we share, the social world that we share. So that's what I'm up to.
That just reminded me of when people say, when you see like a child that has this like spirit, and you're like, they've been here before.
That's what, that child is gay. That's maybe like, they've been here before. Like, that baby's a little queen. That's what they really say.
Ooh, this one got a little sweet.
This one got a little sweetness. Yeah. Too.
Have you ever seen pictures of your parents when they're babies? Mm-hmm. Like your grandparents, and they look grown? Mm-hmm. Like high school photos look like office parties.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, all of our listeners. Please go check out The Inspection. It's available on a bunch of streaming platforms now, so please support. And with that, that's all the time we have this week. This season of Surface Level is presented by Mobi, Mobilizing Our Brothers Initiative. If you enjoyed this episode, please keep the conversation going. Let us know your thoughts and questions at surfacelevelpodcast.com. And remember, stay curious.